Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge today. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Healthcare for all, a goal the White House says can, will, and must be accomplished by the end of the year. A Herculean task if ever there was one. Today, one small step for the healthcare system, but will it lead to a giant step for the under and uninsured? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Monsanto, committed to sustainable agriculture, creating hybrid and biotech seeds designed to increase crop yields and conserve natural resources. Produce more, conservemore.com. American Public Media presents The Next American Dream. What will it look like? Find out more at nextamericandream.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Monday. It is the 11th day of May. In the decades-long stare down over the cost of health care in this country, the health system blinked today. A coalition of interest groups pledged to carve $2 trillion worth of savings out of the nation's health care system over the next 10 years. At a White House meeting with President Barack Obama today, doctors, drug companies, health insurance, and hospital administrators said they would do their part to bring costs under control. But in return, they want a seat at the table in any talk of health care reform. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale has the story.
President Obama reminded healthcare stakeholders of two powerful interest groups that favor reform.
What is a growing crisis for the American people is also becoming an untenable burden for American businesses.
The healthcare industry understands reform is in the offing, and to help avert a competing government-run system, they'll find savings on their own. Though the savings only cut 1.5% in the growth of healthcare costs each year, experts say that's significant. The president-elect of the American Medical Association, Dr. James Rohack, was at today's White House meeting.
We all of those who are involved with healthcare know that we have some waste in our system of overuse, underuse, and misuse.
For example, he says, unnecessary medical tests could be avoided if a patient's doctors could share results. Henry Aaron is a longtime reform advocate at the Brookings Institution. He says it's admirable the industry wants to save money.
But they are legally responsible to their members and shareholders. They have to represent the interests, private interests, of those people.
Interests not necessarily advanced by cutting back on healthcare treatments. But Ron Pollack at Families USA is encouraged healthcare providers aren't campaigning against reforms.
They are enabling themselves to become participants in the health reform process and have a voice in it.
Pollack says Obama learned from President Clinton, who excluded the healthcare community, that it's better to keep all sides in the loop. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Healthcare isn't the only target of reform for the Obama administration. Today it announced it's getting tough on corporate monopolies. The Justice Department started off the morning by tearing up a Bush administration report about dealing gently with monopolists or companies with huge market shares. Then the new antitrust chief started to explain the new policy shift for big business. Jill Barchet reports.
The Bush administration never filed a single case against a company for violating anti-monopoly laws. Obama's new antitrust chief, Christine Varney, promised to prevent big businesses from using their power to squelch smaller competitors.
It is time for the antitrust division to step up its efforts.
It wasn't clear whom Varney would go after first. Herb Hovenkamp is an antitrust expert at the University of Iowa College of Law. He said firms like Microsoft and Intel need to watch out for not sharing information with rivals or for giving deep discounts to computer makers who don't buy competitors' chips.
That will bring us more closely into alignment with Europe, who takes a much more aggressive position on these things than we do.
But Hovenkamp doesn't think Obama's going to break up monopolies, just make them play nicer with the competition. Mark Kovner is an antitrust lawyer at Kirkland & Ellis. He expects his practice, defending big businesses, to get a lot busier.
In an economy that's experiencing some difficulties, people often resort to anti-competitive agreements as their back is against the wall and their profits are going down and they need to maintain their market share and they need to make more money.
Kovner says he expects the pharmaceutical industry to be in the hot seat. for the deals they strike to delay the production of cheaper generic drugs. I'm Jill Barshay for Marketplace.
While the federal government was busy with health care and antitrust today, the state of Massachusetts announced a settlement with investment giant Goldman Sachs over the firm's role in the foreclosure crisis. It appears to be the first settlement of its kind, though likely not the last, as the state goes after investment banks that knew the loans were bad and bought them anyway. Abigail Beshkin reports from WBUR in Boston.
When Massachusetts Attorney General Martha Coakley started investigating the foreclosure crisis, she zeroed in on the role that Goldman and other investment banks played in creating the market for these bad loans.
We've made a determination, and our courts have agreed that many of these loans were unfair. They were destined to fail at the inception.
Under today's settlement, Goldman will spend about $50 million to write down loans for about 700 homeowners whose mortgages are held by Goldman. It also orders a Goldman-owned company, Lytton Loan Servicing, to modify thousands of other mortgages. Attorney General Coakley won't say if she's going after other investment banks, but Vincent Valvo, the editor of Banker and Tradesman newspaper, says they should beware.
You're one of the other major investment banks that were handling these kinds of loans, you probably ought to be getting ready to write a check to the Commonwealth of Massachusetts.
Goldman Sachs says it's happy to have the case resolved. It won't say whether other states have similar cases pending. However, Valvo says it's unlikely.
Martha Coakley has been aggressive at going after the players in the subprime debacle. Interestingly, not in a lot of other states have been following her lead.
Attorney General Coakley says so many things about this economic crisis are unprecedented, it's hard to know what today's Massachusetts settlement could mean for other states. In Boston, I'm Abigail Beshkin for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, the Monday blues stripped away Friday's gains. We'll have details when we do the numbers. If you're lucky enough to still have a job in this economy, it's not only where you're getting your paycheck, but also, usually, your health insurance. We heard earlier from John Dimsdale about the health industry's offer to cut $2 trillion in costs over the next 10 years. Commentator Matt Miller says while health insurance is obviously essential to financial security, the uniquely American idea that employers should provide these benefits is an idea whose time has passed.
GM spends more on health care than on steel, and it's going broke. Starbucks spends more on healthcare than on coffee, and its business is reeling. Corporate America spends more on healthcare than it earns in profits. And health costs have soared from 5% of GDP in 1960 to 17% today. Is it any wonder companies are slashing health benefits? The press usually moans about this, as if firms were doing something awful. And the impact on families surely is. But the larger truth is this. While having health insurance is crucial, it's time we stopped looking to our companies instead of our country to help us obtain it. No one else does, after all. America is the only advanced nation that operates much of its welfare state through corporations. This may have made sense 50 years ago, when medicine was cheap, a single breadwinner worked at a big company for 35 years, and American business dominated the world economy, so that companies could pass on, through higher prices, the cost of much of the country's safety net. But those days are gone. Today, people switch jobs 10 times by the age of 40, and sky-high health costs make U.S. firms uncompetitive. Meanwhile, our archaic link between jobs and healthcare helps explain why 50 million people are uninsured, with millions more just a pink slip away from medical bankruptcy. It's time we faced up to the fact that it would be better for business and for workers to shift the burden of healthcare from business to government. This doesn't mean we'll turn into France or Sweden or Canada. There are market-friendly ways to do this. Government could provide a voucher with which families could buy group coverage from among competing private plans. Lower-income folks would get bigger subsidies. This is exactly how they do it in Switzerland and Holland. Massachusetts is pioneering such a system here. None of this means business would be, quote, walking away from the problem. But the capitalist mind will need a little rewiring. Linking healthcare to jobs is a dead idea, one of those old ways of doing things that doesn't make sense in a 21st century economy.
Matt Miller is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and author of the new book, The Tyranny of Dead Ideas. We want to hear your thoughts. Write to us at marketplace.org. In all likelihood, you own something that runs on lithium batteries. It might be a cell phone, maybe a laptop. The world's lightest material is now also in demand for electric car batteries. But the metal is scarce. About half the world's reserves are in the small South American nation of Bolivia. As Annie Murphy reports, Bolivia plans to make the best of that.
Salar de Uyuni in southwestern Bolivia is best known as the planet's largest salt flat. Some 4,000 square miles, 10 billion tons of salt, and thousands of tourists who come each year to wonder at this vast, otherworldly terrain. It's one enormous flat expanse of whiteness blending into this baby blue sky. You see salt everywhere. You can hear it crackling under my feet. About 25,000 tons of salt are extracted every year, but it's worth little. And for generations, locals like Calixto Condori, who harvest salt here by hand, have been locked in poverty.
This is tough work, and salt doesn't have a high price like minerals. We just don't earn enough.
But that could soon change. Beneath the Salar de Uyuni sit the world's largest reserves of lithium. International investors and automakers like Japan's Mitsubishi Corporation want a piece of it. Bolivia's president, Evo Morales, is determined the lithium won't just enrich foreign interests or the nation's European descended elite. He says ordinary Bolivians must benefit, and he wants the state to have a major stake in lithium extraction. To start, they need to get to the lithium. Engineer Marcelo Castro is overseeing the construction of Bolivia's first and only lithium plant. Today, the site is full of workers bundled up against the cold wind and blinding sun. According to Castro, 98% of them are from nearby indigenous communities.
The flow of natural resources out of Bolivia left us poor, backwards, underdeveloped, and dependent. Only the success of this plant can guarantee that profits will be reinvested in our country. If not, we'll end up the same as before.
But some analysts, like economist Juan Carlos Zuleta, say Bolivia just doesn't have the capital, expertise, or infrastructure to become the world's leading lithium ore supplier.
There has to be some private investment, not only because we are a poor country and we don't have enough financial resources, but more important is that we don't have the technology. It is an error to think that we Bolivians by ourselves are going to be able to go ahead with this important project.
Evo Morales is not ruling out foreign partners, but he's demanding a high price if they want some of the huge profits that lithium should bring. That's giving hope to Bolivians like salt harvester Calixto Condori.
Multinational businesses are usually the only ones to profit in Bolivia, but maybe with lithium, my children and grandchildren will finally get to reap the benefits.
From the Salar de Uyuni, Bolivia, this is Annie Murphy for Marketplace.
Coming up, finding perspective through poetry.
Like many people, I've had economic losses recently, and I think I was focusing a lot on those, mostly in things like the loss of the value of a 401k.
And then something else happened. We'll tell you about it, but first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street was in a selling mood today. The Dow dropped 1.125%, 155 points, to close at 8,418. The Nasdaq fell 0.5%, 7 points, to finish at 1731. The S&P lost 2.1%, nearly 20 points, to end at 909. Financial shares led the charge down market. Bank of America lost more than 8%. Citigroup lost 4%. JPMorgan Chase, 8%. Wells Fargo, more than 5%. Even those banks that pledged to pay back TARP money, they fell today, too. U.S. Bancorp lost 10%, and Capital One bled more than 13%. Bonds rose, the yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.17%, and you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing first-hand consumer reviews on local services like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. Details at angieslist.com. Missed anything from our special financial crisis coverage? You can listen to the entire show or get our After the Bell podcast, a weekly download of the business stories you need to know. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department releases the monthly International Trade Report. Former President Jimmy Carter joins the Senate Foreign Relations Committee for a hearing on energy security. And spoken word from the White House. President Obama hosts a poetry jam tomorrow evening. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdal. There's been a lot of chatter the last week or so about newspapers, not what's in them, but whether they'll be around to break the next big story. As they struggle for a new financial model, this week the Wall Street Journal announced that readers can now either subscribe or pay separately for each story they read online. They're called micropayments. And that got us wondering about other content online and whether people are willing to open their wallets for the things they want. Stacey Kramer is the co-editor of paidcontent.org. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
This is certainly not the first time people have talked about the idea of micropayments, but certainly one of the largest publications to be putting it into practice. Is it going to work?
Well, since we don't know what they're actually going to do, it's really hard to say.
Yeah.
For instance, we don't know if what they're talking about are dollar payments or 5-cent payments. Will you, for instance, buy a pass that gives you access to a certain number over a period of time?
Mm-hmm.
If by paying, do you get a one-time read, or do you get the ability to use it to do other things?
Well, aside from niche publications like the Journal, is anyone else successfully charging for content?
Well, charging for content, yes. And but how they're doing it varies from company to company and from site to site. In some cases, what they've been successful at doing is in getting people, like, say, at ESPN, to sign up for the ESPN Insider, which gives you early access and more in-depth access to sports gossip and sports news and information. And with it, you get a magazine, which is different from signing up for ESPN the magazine and with it getting access.
Right.
Which you can also do, but the idea here is if you're willing to come in and find us online, then you're also a reader for our print publication.
You know, the journalism world is still obviously really grappling with this. But, you know, you look at, for example, the music industry, and it took them a while, but now people do pay per song on, you know, the likes of iTunes. So is it possible to take that example and say, well, maybe we could learn from that?
Well, I think you could, but one of the big differences between news and music, just to backtrack a little bit, is you like to hear music over and over again.
Right.
You usually don't like to read the same story over and over again.
Unless it's really, really great.
Yeah, really great. You know, of course, but you might want to go to the same website over and over again because you like the way that they write or you like their approach. So how do you match that interest with the ability to very quickly charge somebody for something or the ability to layer on?
When you look at content in general on the internet, are we moving toward more free content or more pay content? And here, of course, we're talking about pretty much everything with the exception of retail. I mean, that's an obvious one. But is there a trend one way or the other?
I'm going to say we're moving towards a time when more news organizations are going to be willing to experiment with pay than probably at any time that I've ever seen. People are accelerating their search for alternative sources of revenue, and they're looking at the cable model. It's as much about looking at the cable model as it is about looking at the iTunes model.
Yeah, we all said that we would never pay for television, right?
Well, we all said we'd never pay for television. We all said after we pay, we wouldn't pay to watch HBO or you wouldn't pay to watch Showtime.
Right.
And yet Showtime is having a banner year with subscriptions, even in a down economy. People are willing to pay when it comes to them the way they want it. And that's what everybody is searching for right now, is how do you find that intersection, not just the price that someone is willing to pay, but that willingness to pay for something they can't get in any other way. And that's what it is. It's what people are searching for. And the problem is it's different for every publication.
Stacey Kramer is the co-editor of paidcontent.org, which is a free site, by the way. Stacey, thanks so much.
I appreciate it.
And you can join a discussion about micropayments on our blog, The Scratch Pad. It's at marketplace.org. You are forgiven if you're confused over all the various versions of credit card reform coming out of Capitol Hill. The House has passed a measure prohibiting card companies from calculating interest based on 2 months' worth of transactions. The Senate unveiled legislation today banning cards for kids under 21 without parental permission. And today, lawmakers compromised on retroactive interest rate hikes. You can get your old rate back by paying bills on time for 6 months. Well, President Obama is pushing to get a bill on his desk by Memorial weekend, but the banking industry is fighting back. And as Marketplace's Steve Henn tells us, in many cases, the lobbying effort is working.
This year, John Taylor thought his time had finally come. The consumer advocate wanted a series of reforms, like judges stopping foreclosures and resetting interest rates. He wanted a ban on high-interest payday loans and a tough law to end predatory mortgages. The score on Capitol Hill?
You know, it's the bottom of ninth, and it's bankers 10, consumers 0. It's like being in a street fight, and you and a few friends just went up against 100 other people, and you're just picking yourself up off the ground.
And you're just bloodied.
This Congress has still not outlawed the predatory practices that got us into this mess to begin with.
Taylor says lawmakers have caved on pretty much all his issues, and banks are still fighting reforms that would make jacking interest rates on credit cards harder. So how did the banking lobby do it?
We knew we were going to be up against it, yeah. We knew it was going to be tough here, and so far it has not been as tough as expected.
Scott Talbot's a lobbyist at the Financial Services Roundtable. Talbot's top priority this year was to kill a bill letting bankruptcy judges halt foreclosures and rewrite mortgages. But he was fighting a half dozen different battles.
Cram down credit cards, exec comp, housing, bankruptcy, I mean, the whole bit. I mean, it's been a hyperdrive, blitzkrieg, nonstop, no huddle kind of deal.
And on almost every issue, he followed the same strategy. Bank lobbyists convinced lawmakers to tackle each reform separately and not as part of any must-pass bill like the stimulus package. And when consumer advocates pushed for new rules, bankers would argue that the rules would hurt credit and jack interest rates. But John Taylor at the National Community Reinvestment Coalition says bankers' biggest advantage was financial.
They just spent $42 million in the first quarter of this year in lobbying. I mean, we have the best Congress that money can buy.
Bank lobbyists talk regularly to virtually every member of Congress, and almost all of them got a piece of the nearly $500 million the industry spent on the last election. But Scott Talbot says the industry can't just buy love.
It's not about dollars, it's about information flow. It's about what the right answer is for the economy. And that's where you have to continue to keep focused. All other arguments are red herrings.
But a Democratic Senate leader seems to disagree. Dick Durbin told a Chicago radio station last week, quote, "Banks are still the most powerful lobby on Capitol Hill, and they frankly own the place." In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
We've been asking our listeners to send in their favorite poems about money, work, business, really anything about the economy. Well, an email from Elizabeth Dodge in Culver City, California caught our eye. She wanted to hear Elizabeth Bishop's poem, One Art. It's not really about the economy, it's about loss. But Dodge says the poem has helped her put the economic collapse in context.
Like many people, I've had economic losses recently, and I think I was focusing a lot on those, mostly in things like the loss of the value of a 401k. But recently, that kind of loss was put into perspective for me. Basically, our 4-week-old son became ill a few weeks ago and was taken to the emergency room and diagnosed with meningitis. And for several hours, we weren't sure how he was going to do. And for those hours, there was a potential of a very great loss that really put everything else into perspective for me and for my husband. And it made me think of this poem. One Art by Elizabeth Bishop. The art of losing isn't hard to master. So many things seem filled with the intent to be lost that their loss is no disaster. Lose something every day. Accept the fluster of lost door keys, the hour badly spent. The art of losing isn't hard to master. Then practice losing farther, losing faster. Places and names and where it was you meant to travel. None of these will bring disaster. I lost my mother's watch, and look, my last or next to last of three loved houses went. The art of losing isn't hard to master. I lost two cities, lovely ones and vaster, some realms I owned, two rivers, a continent. I missed them, but it wasn't a disaster. Even losing you, the joking voice, a gesture I love, I shan't have lied. It's evident the art of losing's not too hard to master, though it may look like, write it, like disaster.
Elizabeth Dodge is a physician here in Los Angeles. She wrote in to nominate Elizabeth Bishop's poem, One Art, for our poetry series. The poem is from The Complete Poems, 1927 to 1979, by Elizabeth Bishop. For more on poetry and the economy, go to our website, marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing absolute return funds for all kinds of investors. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
And this final note, an old proverb says it takes nine tailors to make a man. Not quite true for President Obama, who turns to just one, Chicago's Hart Marks, to keep him in sartorial splendor. Well, today, Hart Marks soup makers held a rally in an effort to stave off the closing of their factory. The company has been in Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection since January. The union claims the company's biggest creditor, Wells Fargo, is favoring liquidation to recoup more than $100 million in loans. Wells Fargo says it has continued to provide financing. Maybe they could stitch together a presidential compromise. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow fell 155 points, 1.8%. The NASDAQ dropped 7 points, 0.5%. And the S&P 500 lost 20 points, 2.1%. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Eng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Next time on the program, Hector Torres watched his parents toil for years in the farm industry.
And for me to live through that and see generations and generations get stuck at the same level, at the same job, it motivated me.
College, careers, and the next American dream. I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.